probably the size of a small Buick, and the new one that they put in is probably the size of a large cooler. So, you know, you're going to definitely save money. No way around that. But if you were to put a modern, up-to-date oil boiler in, they're, maybe 20% the size of those old ones, and of course they run cheaper too. You would have saved money. I believe in oil now. I used to believe in gas, but I changed my mind. I think oil is a little bit better. Now with the price of oil being so high, gas has to catch up in price.
Rebuttal.
Yeah, I'm convinced that right now, if I calculate dollars per BTU, BTU is the amount of heat you get out of whatever fuel you're using, and the dollars you pay for X number of BTU is what really counts. With today's prices, I'm convinced that oil is a little bit ahead of the game in dollars per BTU. I know it's a very rare event with some kind of an error occurring, but we all saw on the news last week a house in New Jersey that blew up because of a gas leak. And the neighbors have been complaining for about a week, and the local gas company had been there 2 hours before the explosion that leveled the house and killed the resident. It's rare, but gas does do that. Oil will never do that. The worst that will happen is that if something really bad happens, you'll leak some oil into your basement. And if your system is misset, it'll make some soot. And if it's really misset, it can make carbon monoxide. Well, gas can do that too if it's misset. But for us to be using improperly set oil equipment and compare it to properly set gas equipment might be a little bit unfair. You can tell I'm an oil enthusiast. I'm biased in that direction. I'll admit it. Mel, back with your rebuttal.
Okay. At the time the oil company that we dealt with, he told us that to replace the gas, the oil burner, was around, that time was around $3,600 plus the tank. The gas company came in and put the whole system in for nothing. So it's going to take me a lot of, in fact, I think I'm still working that off somewhat because I know what my bills are in here. So how can I beat that deal? I got a new burner and took away all of the old stuff and everything like that and no charge to me. I think that was a heck of a deal over.
It does sound good. And nowadays, the oil tank itself must be disposed of as a toxic waste material. That can be kind of expensive. I imagine there's no good way of fixing a tank that has developed some rust. In theory, you have to put some sludge buster, I call it. There's a kind of substance you buy that you pour into the oil periodically, into the oil tank, just before the delivery, so that it gets stirred up, which dissolves the sludge and gets rid of the water. It's the equivalent of dry gas for oil, so to speak. You got to put that in the system periodically. That was a very easy thing to do to keep the system running smoothly in the past. All of a sudden, that substance has become very expensive. Not quite sure what's going on there. And so maybe Bob, Rich, and Irwin are going to tell us a better solution to why that stuff became so expensive. But I installed my own furnace. I did that in 1978. I bought the best brand name that was available at the time, retention head burner. I'd forgotten the brand name. I paid $600 and change for the furnace. It did take me 3/4 of the day to do the installation because in my case it was a warm air furnace where I had to readapt the air input and output for the heating of the house, the ductwork I had to readapt, the flue pipe I had to readapt. Everything came out the wrong sizes in the wrong location. So it took me a good, I better say it took me a day for the installation. So it took a day of my time and $600 of change, as I remember, to buy it. And by the same token, I've also installed my own central air conditioning. I'm guessing that had I gone out and shopped around, I would have found a $3,000 price, but the raw materials were $600. And with any further comments, we really ought to move on this one. We're going to pick up this one next week, fellas, because I think you haven't heard the end of the story. KQRIW listening.
W2PNJ.
Yeah, Bob recognized, and I'm supposed to pick up Gordon also. Let me pick up Gordon first, because he's been waiting a long time. W2PTT. K2RIW. You got it, Gordon.
Sounds like there's somebody else trying to get in as well. Okay. I guess my only question is,
the original question, and that is, how can we improve gas furnaces? I assume that they have, you know, manifolds of some sort to inject fuel and do the air mix thing. So how do we tweak those is my question. Maybe the answer isn't here tonight, but I'd love to know the answer. Unfortunately, I'll be in the scout camp next Sunday, so I won't hear the answer. But anyway, question like W3TTT. Okay, there is a so-called pulse-operated or whatever multi-stage gas-burning furnace that a few of my engineering friends have installed. The thing has two or three different stages of heat exchange. The heat exchange is so complete that there is no longer a flue pipe coming out of the gas-fired furnace. There's nothing but a PVC pipe that dumps the water outside the house. In other words, you bring in air, you bring in the gas, you burn the two, you burn it so completely there is nothing but carbon dioxide and water. You cool the living daylights out of it by pushing it through two or three cascaded heat exchangers. And what comes out is very little air, almost all water that drips out of the thing, and as I said, requires no flue pipe. And I think they rate that system as 90-some-odd% efficient. I forget what the number is. So buy the right brand. The only complaint my engineering friends have run into with that particular system I'm describing is that the early versions of it had a kind of stainless steel on the heat exchanger, which wasn't built with quite enough quality to the stainless steel, and therefore some rusting did occur and some eventual failures of some of those heat exchangers, which had to be replaced. But other than that early startup problem of some of these systems, that versus a heat pump is a very interesting comparison as to what's the most efficient and greenest system we should be using for heating and cooling these days. If you took a look at one of the latest issues of, I think it was Newsday, they had a beautiful article about heat pumps, where a heat pump system can be running at a very high EER rating, very little electricity used, to it's basically an air conditioner where it's got pipes in the ground for using as a heat exchanger, and the air conditioner runs in the normal method when it drops in the summertime, and you run it backwards to get heat in the wintertime by drawing the heat out of those pipes in the ground. The more efficient system uses pipes to go down deep, and the installation is kind of significant. But we amateurs that are willing to dig holes in the backyard to install those pipes, you can save yourself a heap of money, I think. Bob may want to make a comment on any of the above. W2PNJ, please draw the interview.
Thanks. I like one of those 95% efficient systems that vents out of a PVC. I was wondering what that was about. So the answer is I'm already there.
Good, thanks. Yes, well done, Gordon. Bob, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, coming back, I ran out to see the International Space Station. What a beautiful view of it tonight. 901 is coming over again at 1039. Yeah, coming back to that oil, the delay valve, they got a thermistor in it to give you that delay. And the big thing is they set up the draft before they let the oil in. So it really brings up your efficiency quite a bit. Keep in mind one thing, though. You reduce your nozzle size, you got to change the dimensions within the nose of that glass tube, with the cone, with regard to the outside edge, then all those dimensions are critical dimensions. You have to change them for manufacturer specs if you do lower your gallons per minute on the gallons per hour on that nozzle. W2PNJ.
A very good point, Bob. And the end of the blast tube has got a kind of a turbulator mechanism, which I think has to be changed when you use a smaller number of gallons per hour, so you get the right swirling of the air that's going to mix with the atomized fuel.
Dimensionally, move it forward or back.
Okay, so you're saying you don't have to change the actual turbulator, you just move it to a different location. In my case, it is indexed to the end of the blast tube. I don't know if I can move it. What I think you're saying is that the nozzle mechanism itself can be moved forward or aft with reference to the blast tube. Is that what you're saying, Bob? PNJ, RIW?
That's correct, Dick.
Okay. Who sells a book that tells you the right setting of
deck in the column?
And whether or not you've got a solid cone or a hollow cone I think there's another factor in the design of the system, solid versus hollow. I think they call it A versus B nozzle, the right location of the nozzle, and the right kind of turbulator at the end of the blast tube. Is there a book where all of those settings for the various brands are recommended versus gallons per hour of the nozzle? Over to you, Bob.
That I have never seen. All I know is I got the manual. Like yourself, I changed my boiler back in the around 86, 88. I put a new Aspen end in the CTO boiler, the fourth draft boiler. It's a unique system. It's got the blower is on the exhaust, and it's just a blast tube on the input. And it's a, you know, wet-based boiler. Very efficient. It runs about 87-point-something% each year on efficiency. And I have the manufacturer's specs. So I know, depending on the nozzle, the gallons per hour on that nozzle, that dimension will change, and that's a critical thing, because they're in fractions, fractions of an inch.
Good to know. And boy, do I like the sound of the exhaust blower as opposed to the intake blower. That way your actual furnace is running at a partial vacuum, and any leak in it will have air running into it from the house rather than flue gases running out into the house. When I first moved into my house, I could look at the ceiling of the house and I could tell exactly where all the rafters were because of the way the soot had gathered on the ceiling because of an improper oil furnace setting. Terrible situation. The previous residents had lived with. So we'll give you some idea of what's going on here. You can also buy a kind of a flue gas turbulator-like thing, flue gas augmenter, I'm going to call it. It's probably got a fancier name. It's sold by Granger. And I bought one of those and only did partial installation of it so far. But that combined with the right kind of a vacuum gauge on the system, you can set up a system where the flue gas augmentator, blower, I'm going to call it, starts up first, creates a very slight partial vacuum in the chamber of the furnace, which then enables the burner to turn on, and that way you know the whole system is running at partial vacuum. And in the case of a warm air system, you've got to worry about the fact that the trap door, when you do the cleaning, no matter how well you seal it, it is capable of doing a little bit of leaking. I think we're going to discuss all of the above further next week. We really ought to get over to Joe, who's been waiting patiently. We're not going to drop the subject. Irwin's going to come back with a lot more information. So will Rich and Bob and Mel. You wait and see. We're going to be cooking with gas and cooking and burning with oil. Any final comments on this one? Okay. Joe, we're going to wait long enough for you to pick up. And what would you like to talk about tonight? The A2RYY. A2RYW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. A2RYY, Joe here. I'd like to find out how I can determine the efficiency of my microwave oven, which is, you know, using microwave, which you're familiar with. I know how much amperage it draws and then how long it takes to heat an 8-ounce glass of water.
You've got the answer right there. Each gram of water takes one calorie to heat it 1 degree centigrade, if I got that right. I think each gram of water, 1 degree centigrade, is one calorie. Now, to convert calories of equivalent heat, BTUs, into watt hours of... Okay, let's see now. Each watt is a... each joule is a 1 second. So, you know how much current you're putting in. You know how many volts you're applying to it. Therefore, you know exactly how many watts for how many seconds are going in. You start off with a glass of water of known volume. And the nice thing about water is it's a beautiful, nearly 100% absorber of the microwave. Maybe your test would be a little bit more accurate if you put in two glasses of water and measure the temperature of both of them. The two glasses are going to be displaced in the microwave oven to make sure you've got them. You're picking up all of the microwaves, if you know what I mean. Do the experiment twice. Once with a single glass and once with two glasses. And once you measure the temperature rise of the water and you know the volume of the water, you know exactly how many watts of energy was put into that water. Ask, did you do the conversion? Now, you're about to ask me, what is the conversion? With a website search on calories of water versus BTUs versus watts of RF energy, you'll know. What I think you're about to discover is the microwave tube itself is the only place where the inefficiency is taking place. And that microwave tube runs at something like, I think, 85%, some really big number, because it's not only putting out the fundamental energy at the 2.4, it's also some hum, and all of those hum into the microwave oven. So you're getting a beautiful conversion system there. And so you're really going to be measuring the efficiency of your particular magnetron. And if you're unhappy with it, then it's time to maybe replace the magnetron. I've never heard anyone complain that at the end of life, the magnetron ran at a lower efficiency. I've never heard anyone complain about that. Once you study the method by which the magnetron oscillator itself works, you'll be amazed how efficient that system is. I wonder if I've given you enough information to go forward with this one, Joe. If not, a little bit of investigation between now and next week. Maybe I can tell you exactly how many watts should give you how many degrees centigrade rise of how many cubic centimeters or grams of water. 1 cubic centimeter of water is 1 gram, by the way. Over to you, Joe, to the E2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Okay, well, I wanted to give you the other information, which I measured, so at least you have, you'd know some. There's no rating on the oven as far as what the unit is as far as wattage. As far as what, like what kind of watt, 650 watt oven or whatever, there's no rating on the back. The only thing it tells you is that it draws 12.2 to 12.5 amps. It says microwave slash heater. The unit was built in 1990. It actually draws about 10 amps, and 2/10 of that 10 amps is used by, one is the bulb inside that heats, that you can let you view inside the contents. The other 10th of an amp must be the electronics display, which is on the front panel. But with drawing about 10 amps of current, it takes, let's see, 2 minutes, takes 2 minutes and 15 seconds to boil the water. So I don't know, that's why I was asking the question. I don't know if that's right or wrong, if you should run faster, cool my amperage, or what the deal is with this thing. That's why I'm asking the question over here.
Okay. When we get a chance, 2 minutes and 15 seconds to boil the water. Whoa! One huge piece of information. How much water?
About 8 ounces, I believe. The glass is 8 ounces of water. And somebody told me a while ago that an oven is rated by how much it can boil, like, say, an 8-ounce glass of water. In so many seconds, I guess the longer it takes, the less efficiency it has, or your tube is starting to get a little soft, or something like that. So maybe you have some more information relative to this.
Okay, you just put in 8 glass of water, and you're guessing that your glass is an 8-ounce glass. Is there a way you can confirm how many ounces of water goes into that particular glass you're using? By the way, the heat that goes into the oven by way of the mold, if it can get 2/10 of an amp, which, by the way, would be 20 watts. Are you sure it's a 20-watt bulb? I think those bulbs are around 6 watts. A little light bulb that's inside the oven. But that is adding heat to the oven. That's not a waste. Every bit of that light coming out of that incandescent bulb goes into that oven. Just a tiny bit of it comes out the screening of the door, if you know what I mean. So that's just another heating element in the oven. That one's not a waste. The 10th of an amp that you estimated goes into the display, yeah, that's a bit of a waste. So I recommend you do measure the amount of water. And by the way, making the water boil is really not a good test, in my opinion. Because, as I see it, the boiling the water is now going from 1 calorie per degree centigrade per gram into 540 calories per gram heat of vaporization. In other words, to boil 1 gram of water, to go from the liquid state to the gaseous state, takes 540 calories instead of 1 calorie. So the tiniest bit of boiling or pre-boiling is going to disturb the living daylights out of the test. A much better test would be to run it for exactly 1 minute or 1.5 minutes and measure temperature with a good thermometer before and after. Do it first with one glass of water, maybe 8 ounces, and then two glasses of water for twice the amount of time. And the glasses, by the way, should be on the turntable, moving with the oven turntable, so to speak, to make sure you're really sucking up all the microwaves bouncing around in there. Because your glass of water is much smaller than the average chunk of food you put in there, as far as latitude and longitude. It's got more altitude, but it's not as big as a chunk of food. You see where I'm going with this one, Joe? Over to you, Joe, KQLIW.
Yeah, and I also said that this flight drew a tenth of an amp, and it drew 2/10 of an amp with the door open or letting the light come on. So I didn't say 2/10, it was just the light. And that would probably equate to probably a 12 or 15 watt light bulb. It works out probably about right. Okay, so you think instead of boiling the water, I should run it for 1 minute and measure the temperature rise of, say, two glasses of water. And I don't have a turntable in the particular microwave I'm talking about. I guess it preceded that.
Every microwave oven must have a turbulator. They do it by two techniques. You've either got a turntable in there that moves, or in the ceiling of the oven, behind the hidden roof of the oven, there is a big blade that moves. You have to move the microwave around. Other than that, your food would have hot spots. If you didn't have a turbulator built into that system, and you put a good chunk of food in there, the left side of it would get burnt and the right side would be ice cold. Because the way the microwaves form a standing wave pattern inside the three-dimensional volume of that oven. There's got to be a turbulator. So you either move the food or you move the microwave. Since you don't have a turntable, and they've all got one, a turbulator of some kind, you probably have a false ceiling in the microwave oven, and there's a great big blade behind that false ceiling that moves. If you either take it apart or look at your owner's manual, I think you'll find out that that's true. I do not know of a microwave oven without a turbulator mechanism of some kind. Back to you, Joe.
Cheers, it's over you.
You hit on something I didn't realize, that that's probably where it is, that there's something in the top of the thing, and it hits the part of the unit, like a false ceiling. Okay. So you suggest I heat two glasses of water and measure the temperature rise after 1 minute, and that would tell you how much energy is being expended on those two glasses of water, each being, say, 8 ounces of water, correct?
You got it. Measure the volume of the water first, either with a good measuring cup or with a good scale, and measure your glass before and after you put the water in it. But by one means or another, either by volume or weight, you're going to know exactly how much water you're using. With a good thermometer, you're going to know what the starting temperature and the stopping temperature was, the temperature delta, roughly 1 calorie per gram per degree centigrade, and your thermometer is going to read Fahrenheit. You have to convert to centigrade, but you can handle that. But now, once you bring it down to a science experiment, a known amount of water, known amount of time, known number of watts going in, and known number of degrees centigrade or Fahrenheit rise of the water, now you've got a real science experiment, and you're traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Back to you, Joe.
Okay. Well, it sounds to me like this is going to continue next week, so I guess I have to do some more, experiment with the thing, more precisely, and I'll come up with some information. I'll present it to you and see what you have to say about it.
Texas KCW.
Somebody keeps signing in so fast that none of us can hear what you're saying. Slow it down 3 steps and try again.
All right, it's KCW. You can't question everything a long, long time ago. I put a microwave and I put a cup of coffee, a cup of water, and again, the water is not boiling. The water looks normal. I put into tea, you know, when the enter again, and the cup splashing.
Okay, there's a lot of people listening on this net. Can any human being tell me what call letters you just heard?
ACQLYU, at Danny.
Okay, LYU. Hey, Danny. Wow, you speak fast. Now, microwaves will work beautifully with heating a cup of coffee, a glass of water, whatever, if it's in a ceramic or glass container. If the water is in a metal container, the microwaves don't get a chance to get into the container. That's what I think you were saying. A metal container, a metal cup, the cup, first of all, 450 megacycles, 2450 megacycles, that's the frequency the microwave oven works at, is a wavelength of 4.5 inches. A 4.5 wavelength wave will not go into an object that is not almost 3 inches in diameter. If the mouth of your cup is not in the right orientation as the metal cup, and not at least 3 inches in diameter throughout the mouth of the cup and all the way down through the depth of the cup, then the microwaves don't go in there. It's called waveguide beyond cutoff. And so that's one funny thing that can happen. People have also put tin foil and other metallic objects into a microwave oven, which you should not do, because you're doing partial shielding. You're going to get the high voltage tip arcing taking place, and so on. So I think these are some of the things that you were saying, Danny. Back to you, Danny.
Yes, it's over here. No, I put a glass of water. It's a special glass, and wait for a couple minutes. The water, no smoke. The water, no bubbles. I put a feedback inside, and the glass, boom, blow up. My hands forget about it. It's all bubbles, a lot of blood coming up. Over.
Okay. Mel, you're an extremely good interpreter. Please tell me what you just heard, because I only got portions of it.
Okay, he put a glass of water in his microwave oven, and it didn't get hot. So he put it back again, and all of a sudden, it's an explosion. The glass flew to pieces, over.
And I heard him say when the tea bag was in there. Okay. I will admit that if you had a glass container, and by the way, many pieces of glass container really have a strain in them the way they were constructed. In other words, because the glass was cooled too rapidly in the process of manufacture, the glass is right at the threshold of snapping, breaking, and so on. You've seen the effect that happens sometimes in a hot parking lot where the windshield, the front windshield of the automobile or the rear window will suddenly crack and turn into a zillion pieces. That means that there was a stress going on. In other words, a portion of the glass was trying to be stretched, another portion was trying to be shrunk, and that stress built up, and with the temperature difference between the inside of the car and the outside of the car, it went beyond threshold. So your particular glass that exploded quite possibly had one of those kinds of flaws. It wasn't properly an error in the method it was constructed. It wasn't properly annealed. It wasn't cooled slowly enough. Wasn't annealed slowly enough when the glass was being... That's a good guess as to what could have happened. Another thing you've got to worry about with microwave ovens is that people have, from time to time, run into a cup of water, which if you had put a thermometer in the cup of water, in the microwave oven, the water is beyond 100 degrees centigrade, beyond 212 Fahrenheit, but not boiling. If the microwave oven just happens to have very low vibration, and yet you're heating the water in a uniform manner, which a microwave oven can do, it is capable of getting the water to a superheated temperature. And then when you just jiggle the cup a little bit, the superheated water turns into an explosive chunk of steam right away. And people have been burned by that. So you've got to be a little bit on the careful side when you heat a cup of coffee or a cup of water. It's a rare event, but occasionally you will go beyond 212 Fahrenheit before it starts to boil. By the same token, if you very carefully cool a chunk of water in a freezer and don't shake it at all, it is possible to get the water below 32 degrees Fahrenheit before it turns into ice. And then you jiggle it a little bit, and all of a sudden it jumps into the crystalline ice mode. So water is a peculiar substance. You can occasionally get it above the boiling temperature without it boiling at standard atmosphere temperature and pressure, standard atmosphere pressure. And by the same token, you occasionally can get it below the freezing temperature without it freezing. And then you get a very rapid reaction when you do a little bit of agitation beyond that point. That's a guess as to what I think could have happened in Doc's case here. Over to you, Mel. I wonder if you've heard of a case like that. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Now, there was a whole thing with this KEY some years ago. There was a whole business that was going on with a caution that if your cup gets the outer portion, if you put a coffee cup mug into your microwave and the mug gets very hot, but the water or the coffee is not heating up, they said that mug has a glazing possibly but with a very high lead content. In fact, for a while they, I'm not that I'm in agreement with this, but they said that you can check the lead content of your mug by putting water in it and noticing if it takes longer for it to boil the water or heat the water than normally, that you should discard that cup because you've got a cup that possibly, like I said, has a glazing that is very high in lead content. I don't know how true or not this is, but they were claiming that my people also would take the mug and soon they pick it up, bang, fly apart, that was a whole thing on television. You know, they were doing it on the news. Of course, they jumped onto it, and I didn't really agree with the heck of a lot of it, but that was what was said. Over.
KC2MIQ.
Go right ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, I just would like to make a query.
Yeah, you're on the list. We were going to go to you next, Charlie, so... For two reasons, you got the floor. You got it, Charlie.
Yeah, okay. I just, it's a super great net. You guys are fabulous. I just wanted to ask for a future bunch of comments on a fuel cell. Could we analyze it and break it down to its basic operation? And, I don't know where it would fit under, you know, our space segment of the band, you know, of the net. But I'm very interested to see, you know, how you break it down and how it's how it operates, and if you put them together like batteries in order to get the voltage that you're looking for. So that was my only comment, and I'll be clear and completely listening out. And thank you for the time. This is KC2MIQ. Back to Nat.
This is an excellent question, Charlie, particularly because we smart amateurs are trying to be more green, trying to be energy efficient. We're a little concerned about global warming, whether it be real or Mother Nature doing it, whether it's man-made or not. Is controversial, but still, we'd like to move in the direction of efficient systems that are economic, that don't create carbon loading and global warming. Fuel cells are one of the things that people talk about. Now, fuel cells were used first, as far as popular places are concerned, on NASA vehicles, both the Gemini, Mercury, and Apollo, and a number of other vehicles. Fuel cells. The most compact substance that you can turn into energy that I know of is petroleum. And so if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to load petroleum onto a space shuttle or onto the International Space Station. Well, for a bunch of reasons, it's not appropriate for a space environment. The next best thing they can use there is a fuel cell. The fuel cell runs on hydrogen and oxygen. You pour, I think it's mostly oxygen. You pour oxygen into the fuel cell, and I think it needs oxygen. Yeah, it needs hydrogen too. It mixes the two together in what you and I would call a reverse osmosis process. I'm using a little bit of a poetic license here. But when you've got the right kind of a membrane, and you've got positive and negative terminals on both sides of that membrane, and you've got oxygen on one side, hydrogen on the other side, with the right kind of chemistry going on, you mix the hydrogen and the oxygen, and the output substance, the waste product, so to speak, of a fuel cell, if it's running efficiently and running well, the waste product that comes out of there is water. It makes H2O. Two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of oxygen mix together. You get water. Ordinarily, if you had a test tube that had hydrogen and oxygen in it because you did some electrolysis of water. You got oxygen out of one test tube and hydrogen out of the other, and you mix the two together, and you put a spark in there, you're going to get a pop. You're going to explode the mixture immediately. Well, in the case of a fuel cell, you could say you explode it very slowly, and you get electricity out as the output. But when it comes to getting electrical energy in space, where you can pack liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen tank for that spacecraft, it's a beautiful, efficient, battery-like system. It generates electricity almost as efficiently, so to speak, as a solar voltaic cell. Does a nice job. Now, you therefore think, gee, let's run on automobiles on those. And at first it sounds great. But where are you going to get the hydrogen from? You've got lots of oxygen.
Repeater, timeout, cancel. We've landed in Uganda.
You've got lots of oxygen running around in our atmosphere. You don't need an oxygen tank to run an automobile with a fuel cell. But you do need the hydrogen. Where are you going to get the hydrogen from? The easiest place to get the hydrogen is to take water and separate it back into oxygen and hydrogen. The oxygen you don't have to bother storing in this particular case. You throw it away, and you put the hydrogen you get out of that process in the tank. You put it into the automobile, and you run the fuel cell. And now you've got an electric-powered automobile. Sounds good. There's a problem. In order to get that hydrogen from that electrolysis-like process, that's where you got these two terminals in the fluid. You pass a current between the two terminals. Oxygen forms at one of the terminals. Hydrogen bubbles form at the other terminal. And you collect those bubbles, and now you've got hydrogen. It takes energy to do that. So therefore, assuming your power station runs on coal and runs very efficiently, and the power they generate without very much loss gets to your house, and you plug in your electrolysis machine that can now generate hydrogen to run your automobile, and you pump it into your tank of your automobile, that's a possible process. But you see that the fuel cell, which sounds so beautiful, still requires energy to get the raw fuel. And if you wanted to have hydrogen being dispensed by your local gas stations, you've now got a huge distribution problem to solve. Where is the hydrogen going to come from? How are you going to pipe it under the ground? How are you going to ship it to all the gas stations? How long is it going to take to establish all the pumps and the gauges and what else so that you can load up with hydrogen each time you go to the gas station, what used to call a gas station? Now it's going to become not a liquid gas station, but a gaseous gas station. But still, I know that President Bush and others have said that we're going to be doing more research and moving in that direction. And I think it's going to help, but it's not a glamour fix. I wonder if a little bit of that makes a little bit more sense, Charlie. KT2MIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2K.
Before we do that, stand by there, Charlie. Now, here's a man who's really running an efficient vehicle, and he knows a lot more about it. Some of what you heard from me was speculation. Eric, tell us the real story.
All right, I want to beat you down a little bit because you have your opinion. They are opinions. Just as an example, okay, let's start by saying hydrogen's really not a fuel. It's a carrier of energy, which means you need to get the energy from somewhere in the first place. Do you agree with that, Dick?
I sure do. There is no free source of hydrogen. We can't go to the nearest lake and collect the hydrogen. We can't easily go to the atmosphere and collect hydrogen. We've got to go and pour energy into something to get the hydrogen. Back to you, Eric.
Yes, you do. Okay. So, now, there's a lot of stuff going on in politics. The other thing that we should talk about is today's version of the fuel cell, which is way different from what NASA used originally. Okay, we work with something called a proton exchange membrane. And every type of reaction, whether you're taking water and taking it apart and turning it into its component parts, or you're taking the component parts and making energy from it. PEM membrane requires a catalyst. And guess what the catalyst is made out of? Made out of platinum. By the way, it has a lifespan. So the way we make PEM fuel cells at this point have an operating time. At the end of that operating time, the catalyst is depleted. Although a catalyst isn't supposed to get used up, but it gets used up in the process over a long period of time. That's the first thing. Okay, if we want to talk about a real example, real-world example of hydrogen fuel cells in an ideal environment, I mean, it's currently now, and I don't know if you guys ever watch CBS, there's a program called Scientific American Frontiers and Dover and a few others that actually covered the subject quite well. But in Iceland, they have an extreme amount of geothermal energy. They do not burn fossil fuel to generate their electricity, although electricity is courtesy of the Earth. So that's one thing. Right? So it is an ideal environment. Cisco and Shell, actually, now there's, in Iceland, there's something like 10 hydrogen fueling stations. The hydrogen fueling stations are basically fuel cells that are running reverse. They get their power from the Earth, and it does the conversion, gives you the hydrogen, and allows you to store that, and actually it generates it directly while it fills up the tank, which is another set of issues. How do you store hydrogen? Okay, so here we have a renewable source of energy. Renewable doesn't have the power density of, let's say, fossil fuels, which are pretty dirty. But it is an absolutely clean form of energy. We use the heat of the earth, we take some water, turn it into hydrogen and oxygen, use that, put it back together, and you get water again, put that back in the atmosphere. So it becomes a complete cycle, and the energy that's providing the movement to the vehicle in the end is the heat of the earth. You agree with that so far, Dick?
Beautiful. I love it. Please continue.
Okay. Now, there is a mindset that because fossil fuels have the highest power density,
which actually it doesn't, but it is one of the easiest things to store,
put in a reasonable volume, and get a fairly good amount of work out of it. The compactness of the fossil fuel, because of the density of the hydrocarbons. Now, what it really is, the burning of anything, creating of energy. Things that burn in oxygen have to have hydrogen. Okay, so fossil fuels are hydrogen connected with carbon, which actually have a little bit of oxygen in them, and they have nitrogen in them. Let's hold them together. We don't have to get into the chemistry of it, but to get the concept. So, based upon that, when we fill up the shuttle, we generate an awful lot of hydrogen and oxygen and make it in liquid form, and we don't do it by pumping it down from air. Actually, what we will do is fractional distillation, have a hydrocarbon component, and usually it's natural gas. We'll separate the hydrogen out of the natural gas, pump it down, pump it up, turn it into liquid, and put that into the shuttle liquid fuel tank. And that's why when you put hydrogen and oxygen together, they're very nasty. Actually, you could take a simple experiment if you wanted to do it yourself. You could take, say, you could actually take a pressure cooker if you wanted to. Alright, make a metal pressure cooker, take a piece of PVC pipe, and mount that where the pressure release is, and make an electrode out of it. Fill it up with water, put, say, a little salt in it, or a little hydrochloric acid, or you can even use baking soda, which is a good catalyst. It becomes an electrolyte. See the little juice, all it takes is about 3 volts, and it will start to bubble. Take the gas that's generated, put it into a balloon, not a very big one, small one, let the balloon expand, tie it off, tie the balloon onto something outside, and maybe wrap a piece of toilet paper around it so you have a little time to run, and light that off, and that small little bit of hydrogen or oxygen will make a very loud, very percussive, rapid burning. Now, think about doing that inside an engine. There you have the ability to use that kind of mixture of hydrogen and oxygen as a direct replacement for a fossil fuel and make an internal combustion engine run, and also give you water on its output. And it goes up. So,
the amount of work that can be done, if you compare, let's say, one drop of gasoline, which you can atomize and spray into a cylinder, versus a balloon that's moderately filled with hydrogen and oxygen. Because the hydrogen and oxygen is in a gaseous state, there's an awful lot of space between the atoms, whereas the liquid is very compact. You good with that, Dick?
Yeah, I think there's roughly a 1,000-to-1 or 10,000-to-1 ratio between these gases in liquid form versus gaseous form. Go ahead.
I agree with that. Okay. So, at some point, we need to get away from the fossil fuels, whether you believe it or not, in terms of that thin little atmosphere, which is actually very thin, especially if you're looking at it from the perspective of the whole globe, has a particular volume, and at some point you're going to overwhelm that volume with other gases that really don't need to be there, which is another discussion for another point in time. But we can make hydrogen from various different things there, and also fuel cells will run. For example, there's a company called Ballard Power. You hook your natural gas line to it, it makes electricity by using a PEM fuel cell, but it also does a little fractional distillation. And unfortunately, one of the bad side effects is it produces carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, which is not necessarily good for the atmosphere. So you have those issues. So the real world, which, by the way, Al Gore, and we've got Teeny Boom Pickens doing his idea, which is not bad. It's part of a step along the way, is to go to totally renewable energy sources, which doesn't involve the process of burning. Because as soon as we get into burning, we're talking about dirty stuff, add carbon to oxygen, and you've got a problem. So, the reality is that there is many different sources of power, but electricity is one of them, right? And for a long time, the problem of, say, using wind turbines and having a transmission and distribution network that runs across the entire country is not an energy lossless system. So if you have a very large wind farm, say, in Nevada, and you want to use some of that electricity in New York, that's not so easy. It's up. But as technology marches on, and as we get into superconductors that start to conduct at near room temperatures, meaning it doesn't have to be doused in liquid nitrogen, those technologies are now becoming a little more mature, and they're beginning to deliver energy using some of these newer technologies in an underground method as opposed to overhead. So that's a step along the way to eliminate some of the energy issues coming from non-combustion sources. Are you good with that, Dick?
Very much so. You've got me breathing heavy. And you've now caused two questions I'd love for you to answer here, Eric. K2EJ, who is the chief engineer for the PBS local channel 13 and channel 21 on Long Island, guy who's got an awful lot of technical background. Therefore, I'm going to hit you with a couple of pretty tough questions. A theoretical situation here, Eric. Assume now that money is no object. You're the president of General Motors, and you're really thinking far out. You're thinking green, renewable, and in the future, and money is no object, and now you're going to develop the world's best automobile. And you, Eric, want to own this automobile. Is it going to store liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen? Is question number one, as opposed to compressed hydrogen. Number two, is the oxygen and hydrogen, or maybe you only need hydrogen because the oxygen is free from the air, is that going to run a fuel cell which runs your car electronically, or are you going to use it as fuel in something like an internal combustion engine? So there's two questions in there. How would you store the fuel to get enough energy density? And the third question is, compare the energy densities of compressed gases, liquid gases, versus the petroleum products we're using right now. So energy density, how would you store it? And how would you use it, electronically or internal combustion engine? K2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, it's a multi-part question with a very multi-part answer because, as you know, technology evolves in stages, and it takes a certain amount of time to bring new technology to market. So we have a couple of issues here. First of all, the car companies still have to build a vehicle, whether you power it by electricity or some combustible material. You still need a shell, you still need wheels, you still need all the stuff that goes with it. So they're not going to go out of business, that's for sure. And if they did make a 100 mile per gallon car, which is entirely possible to do today, with the current technologies that are available, that are actually in use, but they stop short of it a little bit because there is a psychological aspect of this in terms of business. But barring all that, it would become a multi-phase process. First of all, let's talk about storage and what the fuel is. Let me let it drop. There's a guy by the name of Stanley Olshensky who actually is the inventor of the nickel metal hydride battery. I forget which university he was with, but with one of them, I think it was Caltech or one of them, where they actually developed metal hydride. Metal hydride, not solid state. Metal hydride will absorb hydrogen. Metal hydrides can be convinced to release their hydrogen in gaseous form. So now, imagine you build a vehicle. The little pieces of structure that hold the car together, the main frame, the little guiders that hold up the upper part of the cabin, all the things that hold the car together. If you made them out of metal hydride, you can then store a tremendous amount of hydrogen. Actually, I would not go for the liquid hydrogen because that becomes a very, very explosive, dangerous proposition. That's got some very big negatives with it. A high-pressure hydrogen bottle was doable, but I'd rather not. I mean, right now we have high-pressure natural gas bottles on your big buses. I mean, those are very explosive if they were to let go. It's dropped. There are now low-pressure hydrogen bottles, which are not actually that big. They only run at about, 16 bar or something like that. They're less than 200 pounds per square inch. They're relatively low pressure. They are metal hydride bottles, which absorb the gas. And by the way, you can also get heating and refrigeration out of it, depending upon which way you're going. As you release the gas, you can use it as an evaporator for air conditioning. And they can be convinced, just purely on static pressure, which way it's going to go, whether it releases hydrogen or it absorbs hydrogen. That currently is the best technology in terms of storing hydrogen for either internal combustion engine using hydrogen or using fuel cells. So there is your first step in a way towards the future. Okay, the ultimate goal in the end probably would be to have some solar panels in your car, a really, really good energy storage technology in terms of electricity, and use that to drive your motor. Well, you can plug into the big grids that are getting the renewable energy from the sun and the wind and the ocean, and there are actually more ways of generating electricity than just wind and solar the way we think about it. There's also wave energy. There is a lot of other stuff that can be done. There's geothermal, of course. There is temperature gradient, which is also can be geothermal. There are stirring engines that operate on a differential of temperature of 10 degrees and generate an awful lot of energy. So there's a lot of ways to go besides the burning fuel. Second part of your question, Dick?
You give me a lot of information here, Eric. I personally, when I park in this huge black parking lot at one of my clients that I go to, I would be willing to walk a quarter of a mile on a hot summer day if I could park my car in the shade under a tree. If it was 8 bucks, there's a couple of parking places that exist under the tree.
and they disappear immediately. Everybody wants to park their car there. And I'd walk a long distance. You talk to the people in Phoenix, Arizona, they get the same problem. They'd walk half a mile to park their car in the shade so that the seats don't get so hot they would melt in the summertime on completely closed cars so that somebody's not going to steal it. Okay, if we've got these little carports above each parking place in this 1,200 automobile parking lot, which are photovoltaic, and you plug each car into it, now you've got a source of raw electricity. You're keeping the heat of the sun off the car. You've got a source of raw electricity that now you can either put into storage batteries in the car, or you can be running an electrolysis machine, and you've got this pot of water in the car, and it's turning the water into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen is probably flowing away, and the hydrogen is compressing and putting into your nickel metal hydride container or putting into a compressed hydrogen tank. I know it's a little bit fanciful. Is that a possible viable approach? Back to you, Eric.
Okay, the NREL, which is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado, actually has a couple of demonstration stations where they do exactly that. The fuel cells that you use to generate your electricity can also be the fuel cells run backwards that generate your fuel. So, yes, that is an entire possibility. But I believe that there's going to be some more efficient technologies than fuel cells, because they're not that efficient. Whereas that you lose quite a bit of energy in the form of heat. When you put the two gases together, it generates a lot of heat. And also, when you take the gases apart, you generate a lot of heat. Those are the conversion losses. If you actually were to measure as according to the laws of physics, you'll get the sum of everything except for a little teeny bit that nobody knows where it goes, you know what I mean?
Round and round it goes, nobody knows where it goes. That's good. Okay, I like the sound of this. So I can run the fuel cell backwards, it can do the electrolysis of my pot of water. I've now got the liquid, I've got now hydrogen coming out. I don't think I've got the ability in the automobile to liquefy the hydrogen, but I can pump it into the nickel metal hydride or in the compressed tank, and so that my automobile is storing energy from the sunlight shining on this little carport that the car is parked under while it's sitting in the parking lot. So I'm charging the battery, so to speak, of my automobile while it's sitting in the parking lot. I love it. I don't have to keep going to the gas station. I'm getting a big portion of energy for free. The heat that's coming off the fuel cell when you run it can be the heater that runs the heater for the automobile in the wintertime. There's probably a way I can add that heat to the engine and increase its efficiency a little bit. And once I've got a source of heat and a heat sink, like the air blowing by outside, I can now make a thermal refrigerator. Remember in the early days, there used to be a gas-operated refrigerator. As long as you've got a source of heat and a source of a heat sink, an energy difference between the two, you can get either heat or cooling out of that process. So that may be a way that while I'm running my fuel cell, I can get air conditioning out of it with the right kind of a conversion device. K2EJ, K2LAW on TechNet. Boy, are we getting fanciful here tonight.
Tell you about an interesting experiment at K2K Washington.
Okay, Mel recognized. Mel first. I mean, here we go. Eric first. You got Eric.
All right, let me give you a little bit more here. Power density. As I've discovered, the highest power densities of storage is actually zinc air. That's an interesting, a very, very interesting technology, and it's not mature yet. It's a long way from it. When it becomes mature, it's going to be very interesting. I mean, we have hybrid cars now, which, because they're using lithium-ion batteries, some people are using nickel metal hydride. The problem with lithium ion is high inrush and exit current, which is a whole other thing. But as those technologies mature, we will begin to use a little bit less and less in fossil fuel. But we also have this process that if we really wanted to, we can do the conversion. Okay, we can do a lot of different kinds of conversions of internal combustion engines that exist now that we can do tomorrow. You can assist them with hydrogen gas and improve the miles per gallon and reduce the amount of hydrocarbons you put out in the air by causing more complete combustion. That's one thing that you can do. The other thing that you can do is, like T. Boone Pickens says, well, let's easy enough to convert almost every vehicle on the road to natural gas. Diesel's a little harder to deal with, but gasoline engines are very easy to deal with. You can make simple add-on kits, including the cars that use, fuel injection, which just about every car uses today, and convert those vehicles to natural gas or some other combustible fuels. They're a little nicer to the atmosphere. They're still not nice to the atmosphere, but it gives you a way to transition from the vehicles that we have on the road now. As they drop off, they get replaced with the new technology, and eventually you will lose all that bad stuff. All right, let's turn it over to Mel, and I'll take a rest here.
Rest up. I like the stuff you're telling us. Mel, tell us about your experiment. KQRIW.
K1, on a visit to Iceland. They have some amazing things going on there. The system is called the gas diffusion electrode system that they use for generating electricity. And it's fascinating to stand there and watch it and all. And they gave me a pamphlet, I remember. I had the pamphlet here someplace. And this system is based on an experiment that was done by a scientist by the name of Bacon, B-A-C-O-N. I remember that. The only way I remember things is associating, so easy enough to remember bacon with the breakfast and eggs, bacon and eggs. So that bacon being a lot of famous people, but there was a guy, Bacon, that did the work on the fuel cell. Now, this gas diffusion system, if you have this kind of stuff coming out of the ground like they have there, all they want, the whole place is being heated electrically. Everything is being, constantly refueled cheaply by that system that's coming out of the ground there. I was wondering, is there any possibility that there is sources like that in other places in the world that we have not harnessed? Is there places in the United States that we're not taking advantage of? Why are we only thinking of wind or atomic energy? Why aren't we thinking possibly of using something that's like they use in Iceland, something that's cooking down there that we can tap into, Dick, over? Comment.
Okay, I heard comment. I'm going to start with a comment first. The good news about Iceland is they've got a lot of geothermal energy. The reason they got all that geothermal energy is they're sitting on a volcano. And so this hot magma is, to some degree, always bubbling out of the ground. Every so often, that particular local volcano gets angry and gives them an awful lot of grief. So you wouldn't like one of those volcanoes always in your backyard. Hawaii's got another one. A lot of geothermal energy there you could tap into if you wanted to bad enough. I'm not so sure I want to live next to a volcano.